supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we have had the warmest winter in history. And so I predict every one of yous out there is lusting to plant your tomatoes and peppers early this season. We'll talk about the perils and pitfalls that await you after lots of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Catherine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. I'm very excited because you've helped me so much with my gardens over the years, and I'm hoping you can help me today.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. Where are you, Kath?
I am in Norman, Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. Well, you know I'm coming.
I know. I'm going to come in and see and hear you. So
very good. Very good. I'll be at the college, the University of Central Oklahoma, on that Thursday afternoon, the 21st. And then that night, I'll be hosting an event at the Botanic Garden for KGOU.
Which is just such a fantastic community space. The myriad gardens are just awesome.
All right. So what can we do for you now, Kath?
Well, in Norman, we are kind of full of critters. And in my neighbor's yard is a little creek. And so we have just tons of frogs in the trees and toads in the ground. So the frogs and toads, they've never done anything to harm me. And they do like such a great job eating bugs and, you know, particularly mosquito larvae. But I have a horrible frog and toad phobia. And I have a backyard patio with a concrete base that I really like. And I've spent, you know, a lot of time and effort putting around, including some plastic flamingos. And I was wondering if there's anything that I can do around the patio to discourage the frogs and toads from coming up to that area without actually forcing them out of my yard. In the past, I've resorted to, you know, ant deterrent sprays around the edge.
Oh, no, that's
like
mean.
Stop using so many chemicals.
Yeah, no, you shouldn't have to use any chemicals. Now, how long have you had this patio, this little porch area?
Since I moved into the rental house a couple years ago.
Okay. And they are attracted to it?
Well, they like to come up to the walkway to the front of the house and this back porch area at night because the bugs get attracted by the light from the windows in the house.
Of course. Well, I mean, you just answered your own question. If you can make it dark there, they won't come there. But there's also the interesting alternative of, for instance, if you have outdoor lighting, if you simply make it motion activated as opposed to all the time, then say if you want to step outside and it's dark out, as soon as you open the latch of the door, the light would come on for you. But because it would be dark out there at the time, your friends might not be gathering out there having a party. But
during the daytime, the rental house I'm in is only one story, and the buildings both next to us are two story, and we're in the shade most of the day. So during the daytime, they also like to come right up to the edge of the house, I think, to get in the shade and get out of the cool, particularly in the summer where, like, Oklahoma, I mean, we can be 105 degrees every day.
I've been there. Believe me. So, like I said, the first thing we do is limit the lighting around your house at night. And then there's no way that we want to make you less shady. And there are different things you could spread on the patio that would repel them, but I can't think of any off the top of my head that wouldn't harm them because amphibians have a very porous skin. If these were dangerous creatures, there's desiccants that you could use that would dry them out. But that would be mean and terrible. And then you would, of course, have many more insect problems, as you clearly understand. So what I would do, and call me crazy, you wouldn't be the first person to, is at the opposite end of the yard, as far as you can get from your house, but you still have some level of control over, I would put up an outdoor light, a like beach umbrella kind of thing, you know, a windproof umbrella, because, again, I have been in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom, I would have as long and low, like a kiddie pool, a wading pool, as you could. You probably don't want to go near it very often because it would be crawling with them at night and during the heat of the day. But either have somebody rinse it out for you once a week. I don't even think mosquitoes would breed in it because there'd be so many frogs and toads in there. But you could also buy a big shaker jug of BTI granules and put that into the water. That wouldn't hurt the frogs or toads, and it would make sure no mosquito eggs could turn into biting adults. But I think you obviously know what's attracting them to your house, so give them a better option at the other end of the yard. Have a light on out there. Provide some nice shade in the sturdiest form possible. And then a little pool for them to go into. And I think that would cut their numbers coming near your house by 90%.
Thank you so much. That's definitely something I can do.
All right, Catherine, I look forward to seeing you on Earth Day Eve.
Thank you very much. And have a nice episode.
I try to have a nice episode every day, Kat. Thanks. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jerry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just ducky today, sir. How are you, Jer?
I'm hanging in there, anxious to plant my garden.
And where does Jerry hang in?
Well, I actually live to the west of East Tawash, Michigan, which is right on Lake Huron, mm-hmm. North of Saginaw Bay City area, about 50 miles.
Okay, so you have a longer winter than most.
We do. We had some pretty cold weather there this winter, too. Although right now, it's I'm actually in the Florida Keys right now.
Oh,
some of it.
Coward! You ran away!
I know what. I know. I really am. March March kind of marks the coming of cabin fever for me, so I usually have to bail.
Okay, so put your mind back in Michigan. What can we do for you?
I'm interested in you know, what to do about pruning apple trees, and also I've got a question about cherry trees.
Okay.
So,
well, apple trees
yeah.
are pretty easy. They're a very good crop for a cold climate. Apples have what's called a chilling requirement. You really can't grow them in extremely warm areas, or you have to get very specialized trees. And one thing I've learned with my peach trees is you can, for instance, one of the answers is you can prune your apple trees in the middle of winter, and that'll be perfectly fine, and you have a lot of winter to have the middle of. So some yes. experts would tell you to do that. What I've learned with my peach trees is I like to wait until they flower, and then I can see any parts that you know, that didn't make it or anything like that. But I can also take my prunings inside and have all these flowering branches throughout the house. So, in other words, you have a lot of wiggle room. You can do it in the middle of winter, mm-hmm. or you can do it as they're flowering.
Okay. Any special technique or part of the branch that you don't prune or...
Well, you want to take out entire branches. You want to take out branches that are pointing straight up because that's the lowest chance of them having fruit. Lateral branches have the most fruits. You want to get rid of branches in very crowded areas. And with apple trees and peach trees especially, it's always smart to cut the tallest branch from the time that the trees are little. And that's called creating a new central leader. That's one way to keep the height of the tree under control. And again, you want the pruned tree to look like an umbrella. You don't want it to look like a closed umbrella.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And can I ask you something about cherry trees?
Go ahead.
I had a number of cherry trees growing. I think they were Bing cherries. They seemed to do real well in that climate. But we had 3 years in a row where we had early warm weather, they blossomed, and then we had frost, and it was fairly serious. And after 3 years of that, the trees all died.
Yes, this is one of the biggest perils of professional orchards. I mean, can you imagine that this is your livelihood? This is your mortgage. and the trees flower and you know it's going to drop into the 20s a week from then. What they would do in a professional orchard, oh my goodness, back at the turn of the century, they used to dig trenches and fill them with diesel oil and set the lanes on fire to actually artificially heat. Oh, it was a terrifying. More recently, they've used smudge pots or propane heaters. But my cheap and sleazy trick is old Christmas lights, old regular Christmas lights from the 70s, you know, the kind that heat up, regular incandescent C5, C7s, and just throw those up in the trees, turn them on at night, and they tend to generate enough heat to protect the trees against frost.
That's a great idea, and I got a bunch of those, boxes of them, actually, in the attic.
And I miss them. I mean, I have LEDs because they make sense and because, you know, it's environmentally sound. But I miss the ones that you could light your head up by sticking your finger in a light socket, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, thank you very much. I sure appreciate the information.
All right. Good luck, Jerry.
Well, thank you.
Take care, sir.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll do two shows on Saturday, April 2nd at the Del Valle Home Show at the Ice Works in Aston, PA. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with hot sun, cold tomatoes, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's been a warm winter almost everywhere. People are itching to put their tomatoes out early, especially in places where summer heat often shuts the plants down. We'll talk about the tiny little road you can take through the middle of that to tomato success after lots more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Paul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Paul. How are you, sir?
Oh, finally drying out a little bit. We've been getting some storms here.
And where is here?
Carthage, Texas.
Carthage. Now, I've heard of that. Where exactly in the state is that?
It's up near Shreveport, Louisiana.
Oh, okay.
About 30 miles inside the great state border.
Very good. Okay, what can we do for Paul in upstate Texas?
Yeah. I got married a couple of years ago, and my wife has kind of turned me into kind of a beer snob. She's really big on IPAs.
Oh, yeah, I'm right there. I'm a hophead.
Oh, you and her would have a great conversation.
Oh,
she's a teacher, so that's not possible to do right now.
Right, I'm a total hophead, man. I don't drink a lot of beer, but when I do, it's hoppy.
When we got married, she saw my property, and she was really big on the idea of trying to raise hops mm-hmm. from rhizome. Problem is that last year and this year is kind of different. We have been just basically flooded with water. So we either have an abundance of water or we go into basic drought around here. My soil is real clay, and I was thinking about building her some raised beds because you talk about raised beds all the time. How big does this raised bed need to be in order to properly be able to provide for these individual little rhizomes, and what kind of hops were probably the best to do in that area for her?
Well, here's the deal. I helped a local brewer here in Pennsylvania set up a little hop farm. Now, they gave up for the same reason that a lot of people give up. They're big plants, they're a little difficult to care for, and they cannot stand humidity. If okay. we have a humid summer, hop plants suffer. So the growing of hops has kind of fallen into areas a lot like the finer wine grapes that are dry, that are, you know, not centers of humidity. I mean, you mention anything about Louisiana, and for instance, I can tell you probably it's the only state I would say you can't grow a hop anywhere. You know, because it is so famously humid there, maybe Missouri as well. But hop plants do not so much go out as up. They are climbing plants. I had friends here in the Lehigh Valley who successfully grew hops every year. They returned every year, and they started on the ground underneath the deck that was on the second floor, and they grew all the way to the top of the house, trailing up different suspension systems and stuff. And they never had any issues with them. I was amazed by the size of the plants. They grow anywhere from 10 to 20 feet high in a season. So the issue is getting them in an area that's going to have the best wind, air circulation, okay. and morning sun. If they dry off in the morning and there's good airflow, they should prosper. I don't think they need especially rich soil, but instead of building a raised bed or something like that, I would just add a lot of compost to the surface of the soil where the rhizome is buried. What you'll have to do is research on support systems, because, again, these things get a minimum, I believe, of 10 foot high in a season, and that's a really poor season. And they get really heavy, and they need a lot of support.
Well, okay. Yeah, humidity, we often deal with 100% humidity here. So that's a problem. I could build her whatever trellis system she needs for this, and that's not a problem. What would you suggest? You said to build up the soil.
Okay. No. I would probably just put the rhizomes in the ground, and then as the plants grew, I would shovel compost around them
okay.
on the surface. And perhaps not too much. You'll need to do a little bit of research. If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, click on Garden Answers A to Z. I did an article when I helped with this hop farm, help establish this hop farm. We did an article about it. And that's, of course, under the letter H at Garden Answers A to Z. I can't remember everything, whether they want a rich soil or a poor soil, but that would be there. And then your Texas extension system would probably be able to recommend what varieties might have succeeded. I can tell you off the top of my head, I can't think of a single hop farmer in Texas, especially your part where, again, you have some humidity. So the choice of the specific hop plant you would grow is going to be essential. And I would plant only a few of them, and I would plant them like 20 feet apart to make sure that there was good airflow between them. And again, morning sun. And if it doesn't work, if they get all mildewed and stuff, well, then you tried. You did your best.
Okay.
All right, so read up on it, Paul, at our website, and then ask your local extension office if anybody in your area has ever had success, and find out the variety name, and then give it a shot.
Not a problem. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, sir.
Have a good day. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Ellis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Ellis, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, enjoying the early days of spring and moving forward.
And where is this taking place?
I'm in Oklahoma City, just a suburb north of Oklahoma City.
All right, so what can we do for you right now, Al?
Well, I've got a couple of rose bushes, and they're really sentimental to my daughter. And I like a low-maintenance garden, and roses are not low-maintenance. So I was wanting to know how to make them a little bit less maintenance. And the problem I'm having with the bushes is they seem to be diseased.
Mm-hmm.
One was a gift when she was in the hospital. One was a gift, and we actually planted it, and it lived. So that's a very short-stemmed flower. And, you know, and then the other one is a traditional long-stemmed rose bush, and it's about 6 foot tall, and I don't know how far I can take it down to bring it something a little more manageable for us. Both of them kind of show the same signs of disease. The stems are browning, or they'll show dead gray at the top. Some of them have become dead all the way at the root.
Oh.
And so last year we thought we lost them, but now they're showing green.
Roses are surprisingly hardy. And I find mine to be totally maintenance-free. But that's simply because I've learned how to take care of them. Now, first thing I want to ask is, are they mulched with anything?
Yes, they are.
What are they mulched with?
A dark ground wood chip mulch.
Ding, 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 ding. That's killing them.
Oh.
If you were a plant pathologist, Elle, if you were a researcher at Oklahoma State or the University of Oklahoma, and you wanted to breed rose disease, you would go to the garden center and buy that same bag of triple premium shredded bark that you have underneath your roses, because you know that fungal organisms love to breed in wood, and it is the best way to get the most disease happening quickly. So right now, as soon as you're done, get out there and move that mulch 6 feet away from any part of your rose plants, and you have now, in that simple act, you've already cut the disease pressures by more than half.
Nice.
Okay. Now, you say your roses are greening up.
That's correct. They are turning green.
Okay. But you're still not out of danger of having a frost.
No, that is correct. It looks like we've got nice weather for the next couple of weeks, but we could have a frost as late March. So
what I want you to do is I want you to get rid of all that wood mulch that's anywhere near them. It's not really good for any plant, man. The only reason it's so prevalent is they stopped accepting wood waste in landfills, and that's when you started to see all these mulching seasons around people's houses. Now, where you are in Oklahoma, you can get pine straw mulch for your other plants, but I want you to get compost to mulch your roses with. Compost is the opposite of wood mulch, whereby wood mulch breeds disease, compost suppresses it. So get rid of the wood mulch right away, then just leave them alone. And then when you think you're out of the range of you having a hard frost, get out there and prune them. I want you to remove any dead, damaged, or diseased wood. You can prune them back pretty hard if you have to.
Okay.
And if you are cutting out a diseased section, don't use bleach or anything like that. Just cut into healthy wood. Don't cut into the diseased part. You know, cut below it, and then get rid of all, put all that stuff out in the trash, the diseased part, and then mulch the roses with compost.
Okay.
And then you should have a relatively trouble-free summer. You don't prune them in the fall, do you?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good. So that's the plan. Get rid of the wood mulch, prune them as soon as you're confident you're not going to get a hard frost, get rid of any dark, black, any dead, damaged, or diseased parts, and then give them a 2-inch mulch of compost, and I predict you will not see disease on these plants ever again.
Awesome. Mike, I really appreciate your help. Thank you, sir.
All right. Good luck, Ellis.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rebecca, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am just ducky, thank you. And where is Rebecca doing well?
I'm in northern New Mexico.
Oh, okay. What an interesting climate you have.
We're up in the mountainous part of New Mexico, above 8,000 feet here.
Wow. So what can we do for you?
I have a question about my Latham raspberry plants that I planted 7 years ago into a raised box that we built. We originally filled it with soil from a nearby corral that used to have cows in it over 30 years ago. These plants, they grow green leaves, very, big and bushy, but I haven't seen flowers on them. There was only one summer that one cane on one of the plants had 5 raspberries on it.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I'm not seeing any berries, but not even any flowers.
You have treated them backwards. Raspberries do not want to be in a raised bed. Raspberries do not want to be in a rich soil. Raspberries are, in the best sense of the word, trash plants. They like to grow in flat ground, in your worst soil. My plants, which I put in pre-1990, are still sending up fresh canes in the same area. I planted them in my poorest, rockiest soil. And over the years, I'd say on average, they get a shovelful of compost every 4 or 5 years. That's the entire source of their nutrition. Yours sound like overprivileged children. Their soil is too rich. They're in a raised bed. But your timing is very good because, as you know, the plants have thrived for you as plants for the past 7 or 8 years, you've said, right?
Yes.
So is there a place, and because you know what's going to happen in a month or so, new canes are going to come up out of the soil. Do you have a place that is less nice to transplant them to?
Yeah, I do, but one of the problems is we have clay soil, so it holds a lot of wetness. Is that a bit not a good idea for raspberries? They need dry soil?
Well, they do prefer dry feet, so to speak. There are many experts who've told me the only thing that can kill raspberries is wet feet. So you were doing this for drainage, huh?
Yeah.
Well, do you have a good run of canes? You know, for people who don't know, raspberries are perennials whose plants die every 2 years. They send up new shoots in the spring, and those shoots have the capability of flowering and fruiting that year and the next. Then that cane dies, but new shoots are coming up all over the place all the time. If you get enough new shoots, I would take a crapshoot. I mean, you can leave some of the canes in your raised bed system, but I would transplant a lot of the young canes to other areas and see where they thrive. You know, it's so weird because I'm trying to figure out in my head, is there a way you can make this raised bed less nutritious? You haven't fed them anything since you built this thing, have you?
No, the only thing I have put some more of the soil from the corral on top of them probably 2 or 3 times over the last 7 years, and then I've put some pine bark mulch 2 or 3 times over the same 7 years.
Okay, well, the mulch is certainly no good for them.
Okay.
They don't need that. Matter of fact, that'll hold dampness around the bottom of the canes. But it doesn't sound like that's your problem. I would start transplanting them to different parts of the yard, to areas that are, especially if you can find some areas that are rocky underneath the clay, because that's going to drain pretty good. But no more manures of any kind, no more rich soil of any kind. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised by how they do when you stop treating them so nice.
Okay. So if I do try different varieties of raspberries, I should stay away from using the raised bed? Then?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you want to go out and get some topsoil, just some almost fill soil, just to raise the level, but I would avoid anything that had any nutrients in it, like old cow manure and stuff like that. And if you're going to try some new varieties, if you're going to get some other types, I would highly recommend Heritage, which is the raspberry that I grow, which has always done well for me. It's hardy as all get out, and it produces two crops a year.
Okay, so well, when we originally got the Latham, we also planted three Heritage, and they did well that first year, but they didn't make it to the next year, and they were also in a raised bed with the same dirt, so maybe they didn't like that.
Yeah, use your raised beds for tomatoes or peppers or something like that with some season-extending devices, but get the raspberries in poor soil, and I think they're going to take off for you.
Okay, sounds good. I'll try that.
Okay, good luck, Rebecca.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will present a workshop on composting and another on gardening in the shade on Saturday, April 9th at the Lancaster Master Gardener Symposium in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with hot sun, cold tomatoes, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, which I think will apply to 99.4% of you listening out there. Itchy fingers after a warm winter. How early can we plant? What are the perils? And why can't we plant early, especially if summer gets too hot? We'll go into all the details after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Anne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Anne. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks.
And where is Anne very well?
In Norman, Oklahoma.
Very good. Storm and Norman, I'll be there on Earth Day Eve at the university.
Okay. Well, I look forward to your visit.
Yeah, I look forward to it, too. What can we do for you right now?
Well, my problem is with fire ants.
Oh, nasty.
And, yeah, I just discovered them here recently. And I went online, and it was kind of an involved thing. They said, get a couple of 5-gallon buckets and work quickly early in the morning while they're all still in the snow, and dig up the ants and fill up the buckets halfway, and then, you know, get your hose out there and drown them in sensory.
Oh, my goodness. That is of the dumbest advice. I mean, that's dumber than dirt. That whoever put that up doesn't have the brains that God gave geese. You get stung so many times, and
that's what I was thinking, and I had visions of just frantically trying to dig these little guys up before they just scattered and regrouped someplace else.
There can be tens of thousands of workers down there, and their venom is as powerful as yellow jacket venom.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. No, people die from, you know, falling into fire ant mounds or developing an allergic reaction or just by being stung by 100 of them. No, that is dumb. And you should go back to that website and tell that person to find the rock they crawled out under and get back under it real fast. And stop giving bad advice. No, there is a real good organic solution to fire ants. Actually, there's several of them right now. First, I'll tell you about the one that we learned about years ago. It's called the Organic Texas Two-Step.
Okay. Now,
fire ants are a big problem in many parts of Texas, and I believe it was researchers at Texas A&M who came up with the, quote, two-step. And this was a combination of two typical pesticides that they would treat the mound with. And then by special request, these exact same researchers came up with an organic option. And it involves two very safe materials. One is essentially orange oil. The scientific name is D-limoline, but there's a product out there called Orange Guard. That is sold,
Orange Guard,
that's sold as an insecticide, and you drench the mound with it. You know, you just pour this stuff, and the one part that they got right is early in the morning, if there's a chill in the air, they'll be down low. So you get a couple of minutes to work, but no way should you ever touch the mound or, you know, be there for more than a couple of seconds. So you pour a bottle of this Orange Guard down the hole, and then you get a relatively new brand of organic insecticide that are generically called spinosads, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. And you can find all this information online. If you go to our website, go to Garden Answers A to Z, go to F for Fire Ants, you'll see this stuff. And spinosads are a naturally occurring soil organism. But when it gets onto the ants, it develops a kind of a fungal infection, and the whole colony dies. There is also a very new product out there. They advertised on our show for a while. I don't think they're underwriting us now. They may come back. Who knows? I don't talk to the underwriters. But they have a great product designed for two different types of underground creatures. And it's exactly the same product, I believe. One is called Mole Zap, and the other is called Ant Zap. And why they called it Zap, I have no idea, because there's no electricity involved whatsoever.
Okay.
But what it is carbon dioxide. It's medium-sized cylinders of CO2 and a little hose and a portion that, you know, covers the hole, so to speak. So you cover the hole with this kind of a covering, and then you turn on the CO2 cartridge and you run like heck. And what happens is it displaces all the oxygen down in the colony and they die. So, and no poisons whatsoever. It's an amazingly good way. If you're near an electrical outlet, another way you can deal with these creatures is they're very attracted to electricity for some reason. They are actually a big problem for the electric company to get into the boxes and everything.
Oh.
But if you can find one of those old-fashioned bug zappers that people would put out by their pool.
Okay.
And run an extension cord out to where the mound is. Lay this thing down and turn it on. The ants will just throw themselves at it by the thousands until they're all gone.
Oh, excellent. Okay, very good.
And be very careful around these mounds. These creatures are responsible for deaths every year. I mean, they're very nasty characters.
Wow, for heaven's sake. Well, I'm so glad for the information and the word of caution here. And I really appreciate all your good advice.
All right. Well, good luck, Ann. Be careful.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Arlena, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call and for sharing your knowledge of sustainable gardening.
Oh, aren't you the sweetest? Thank you so much. Where are you?
Havertown.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
Now, you know, we've been talking a lot about town names. You know, Hatboro, person was telling me, you know, that it was a center of hat manufacturing. Do you know where Havertown comes from?
I have no idea.
Okay, that makes two of us. What can I do for you?
Well, I have heard you talk about using castor oil pellets for voles and moles, and I looked up on your questions A to Z, and it listed, you know, for voles to try the castor oil pellets. And my question is, if I put it in the, I would use it on the lawn, but then I would also need to use it in my garden where I grow vegetables. And will it change the taste of my vegetables and I have a fig tree? Is it going to affect the flavor of anything?
Absolutely not. Castor oil, true castor oil. One of the issues, you know, this used to be a home remedy for moles and voles when back in the day when castor oil was a very common kind of supplement health food. I think personally my grandmother used to give me castor oil, not because I wasn't feeling well, because I had misbehaved. The stuff tasted terrible.
Yeah.
But over the years, they found a way to process it so that it didn't have any taste anymore, but theoretically still had whatever good pop, you know, good things about it that we were taking it for back then. But it is the smell of castor oil.
Oh, it's the smell, not the taste.
Correct. Okay. No, they're not eating it. Moles, M-O-L-E-S, only eat live food. They only eat earthworms and beetle grubs and cicada larvae. And voles, V-O-L-E-S, the nasty little shrew-like creatures, they only eat the roots of plants.
Right.
But they both live underground. The moles more so than voles. Voles live much closer to the surface. But they are very conscious of the smell of the soil.
Ah, okay, it's the smell. Okay.
So when these specialized garden products had to be made, because when you went out and bought castor oil, it didn't stink. So every gardening company that has a natural product line has some version of either liquid or dry castor oil that not only still has its smell, but they've tried to make sure it has the strongest smell possible. So you either spread the granules around or you spray the liquid around. But the nice thing about it is the scent goes down into the soil. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't stink up your property like, you know, when you get a load of trashy mulch or anything that.
Right. Yes.
It goes down into the soil. So it's not going to affect the taste of things like tomatoes, or you mentioned you have a fig tree.
Right.
But, you know, as you were asking the question, I was wondering about potatoes.
Well, we don't grow them, but
I'm just thinking out loud, though, that something you apply to the soil that seeps down into the soil, that changes the smell of the soil, I'm wondering if it would affect at all the taste of a root crop.
A root, right.
Yeah, but and the answer is I don't know. If anybody out there does, I'd love for them to call in. But I can assure you it's not going to hurt
anything above ground, which
correct.
Is what I grow, like squash, tomatoes, cucumbers, right? I don't grow root vegetables. And can you put it down twice a year? Could you put it down in spring and in the fall?
Yeah, yeah. If you've got a real bad vole problem, I would put it down in the spring and follow it a month later in the spring, because you really want to make them uncomfortable in your environment before they start breeding heavily.
Right. Okay. Okay.
All right.
Okay. That's great.
All right, Arlena. Thank you very much. What a great call.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for the question of the week. The perils of early planting and cures for hot summers. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Lisa in Oklahoma City writes, "My father and I are having an argument. I have a bachelor's in botany, but he has more gardening experience than I have years in my life. Oklahoma City has been having an incredibly mild winter, and our last frost dates have been coming earlier and earlier. I think the most recent was around March 30th. So I think we should put our peppers and tomatoes out now and cover them with blankets in case of a cold snap. Dad thinks we should wait until after the last frost date. I'm concerned that if we wait that long, summer will set in early as it often does here, and we won't be able to get any good harvest because of the heat. Is there a middle ground, or is one of us right?"
Well, Dad's right. In fact, he's doubly right, because he's saying after the predicted date of your last spring freeze. The nights are often still bitterly cold when a region reaches its, quote, last average frost date, and tropical plants like peppers and tomatoes don't need to actually freeze to suffer. Being exposed to nights in the mid-30s can set their growth back by several weeks. And I did some research, and back in 2014, the records showed that it dropped to 34 degrees in Oklahoma City on April 15th.
That is too cold for tomatoes. But why 2014 and not 15?
Ooh, I looked at the wrong year. I keep thinking it is 2015 now. Anyway, Lisa does have a good point about summer heat. In a follow-up email, she explains, "We've had a lot of trouble with tomatoes in particular struggling or refusing to set fruit after daytime highs get up into the 90s, which is one of the reasons for me wanting to get them started and out so early."
Wait, in her original email, she said she wanted to put the plants out, quote, now. But you need time to prepare these answers. When exactly did she send you this question?
It was right around the end of February, which means she had spring fever and cabin fever. Now, I understand the temptation when winter weather is warm, but you got to temper it with reality. It's going to drop close to or below freezing before she gets to April, and gardening is a game where cowards win. My, quote, last average frost date is mid-May, but I often wait until June to plant. A good rule of thumb is to be ready to plant on your last average frost date, but check the 10-day forecast and look at the nighttime temps. Anything below 45 is not ideal, and below 40 is really dicey.
And covering the plants with, quote, blankets would just crush them.
Right. Now, it's perfectly acceptable to start your plants early, keep them indoors under lights or in a greenhouse until temperatures approach normal, and then take them outside. But don't plant them immediately. Keep moving them into bigger pots and be ready to bring them back inside if you get a sudden cold spell. That way, they'll be safely older and much more acclimated to the outdoors when you finally do plant them.
What about season-extending devices?
Ideal for this situation, but it's easy to accidentally harm your plants with homemade structures, so I strongly suggest investing in a set of grow tunnels. These are row covers that are already attached to hoops, so they have a sturdy structure. They allow you to put tender plants outside weeks early, and you can use them to grow cool season crops like spinach and lettuce long into the winter, maybe even straight through to the spring.
Well, that sounds pretty good. How long do they last?
If they're stored away carefully for the summer, they would last many years in Oklahoma. Mine have even survived some really nasty winter ice storms.
Okay, now what about hot summers?
Well, you know, in really cranky areas like the deepest south, many gardeners just treat summer like winter and plant early enough to take a break by mid-July or so. But there's lots of tricks you can play in, quote, normal hot regions like Oklahoma. For instance, just planting your tomatoes where they'll get morning sun and then some afternoon shade.
Right. You always say that full sun on a plant tag means full sun in the north, but it means please give me some afternoon shade as you move south and southwest. Can you provide that shade artificially?
Every nursery and garden center does. Once things heat up, they run what's called shade cloth over top of their greenhouses to cut the intensity of the sun. And you can build a home system. Shade cloth is widely available, and, quote, all you need to make it work is a big series of hoops to run it across. Use quality materials that'll last for years, and the amortized cost would be very reasonable. But I have one big disclaimer for this specific region. I've been there. Oklahoma is where the wind really comes whipping down the plains. In a relentlessly windy area like this, you're going to need a really solid design and extra strong materials, or it'll be gone with the wind by August. Well, that sure was a lot of information about hot and cold running tomatoes now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to freeze my tomatoes if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden show at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location or we will enroll you in the spam of the day club. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you are, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineers this week have been Al Banks and Kevin Griffin. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website warm, assisted by the savage she-devil Sarah Kazar. Always early is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, is frequently late. Our intern, Eileen Kelly, follows the sun. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I really do wait until around the 1st of June to put my tomatoes out because gardening cowardice has always served me well. So I'll keep my baby plants inside and up close to their lights long after I see you again next. Need to take a year off from growing? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll talk about how to protect and even improve your garden beds when you need to take a breather for a season, plus your fabulous phone calls.